Word on Today FM.
John Gibbons is with us for a weekly Last Word on the Environment, and we're going to start by talking about Pope Francis and the environment, because he did make a major statement on the environment a few years ago, which I think has there's a backlash to an extent against the woke Pope when it comes to the environment, isn't there? There's elements who are now hoping for a sort of a MAGA Pope in Rome to roll back on the type of things that Pope Francis was concerned about.
Yeah, good evening, Matt. Yeah, I suppose Francis was an exception. The first thing to say about him, I suppose, is that he was the first Pope from the Global South. So he brought a completely different perspective to the job. His predecessor, people will remember, wore very, very stylish red Gucci shoes. He was very much a style queen. Francis brought a humility. He, for example, in Argentina, he travelled by public transport. He drove a tiny little car. He lived genuinely humbly. So he brought that perspective, as I said, from the Global South, and I think he brought that into the papacy with him. He probably wouldn't have been a natural environmentalist. I think he learned on the job during his papacy. And yeah, the first encyclical that he produced in 2015 was called Laudato Si, which just means praise be unto you. And I have to say, it's the first papal encyclical I ever read, and it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant, and he wrote it himself. It was a thundering jeremiad against globalization, against trickle-down economics, and against the injustices of the rich against the poor. And he really framed, Matt, I guess, climate injustice in those terms as an attack by the powerful upon the weak. And that isn't just poor people, but also, of course, the most defenseless of all, which is nature. So he framed it very much in those moral terms. And it is a bit of a break, because previously, I suppose, our Catholic Church in particular, and maybe Pope specifically, they tended to be more focused on the other place, other worlds. And really, Francis is probably the first time you can say this is a Pope whose feet were firmly buried in the soil of this planet. And he brought a respect and a humility, if you like, to the job that we haven't seen before.
Well, he wasn't a climate change denier. He wanted the world to confront climate change, the loss of biodiversity and ecological degradation. And he wanted them not just to be political or scientific issues, but to be a moral one as well.
That's correct. And in fact, he returned to this subject in 2023. So after 2015, he produced a new encyclical called Laudato Deum. Now, I know I'm beginning to sound like a papal scholar here, and this is the second encyclical.
Don't flatter yourself too much, though.
This is my second one that I actually read. And again, powerful stuff, very much focused, if you like. And as you said, he turned on climate denial. He said, in recent years, some have chosen to deride these facts. They bring up allegedly solid scientific data and so on. And he said, regrettably, the climate crisis is not a matter that interests the great economic powers, whose concern is with the greatest profit possible at minimal cost and in the shortest time. In other words, the quick buck philosophy that is burning down the world. Now, his departure, I think, is an enormous loss of moral leadership. Whether or not you're a Catholic or have any religious persuasion whatsoever, he was a world figure, one of the very few consistent world figures to speak out in a way of framing the climate and ecological emergency in a way that connected maybe with people, for example, who maybe Greta Thunberg and people like that wouldn't have been able to reach. And it is a point, and I think we have to say it here in Ireland, that there's very little indication that the hierarchy in this island ever grasped climate or ecological issues. They brought a more traditional conservatism, which unfortunately didn't extend to protection of the natural world. So Francis was an anomaly. And to return to your opening remark, Matt, the question here, are we about to lose, or have we just lost a champion? And are we likely now to see a papal backlash in terms of a much more conservative figure? That remains to be seen. Obviously, Conclave will decide. But I think Francis has been reasonably canny, I understand, and he's placed quite a number of like-minded cardinals in the ring. So
it's all about politics, the Conclave, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. I mean, the papacy is the ultimate political forum. And think about it, this is an empire or whatever you want to call it, a dynasty that stretches back, you know, millennia. I mean, it's the most, if you like, the most enduring political institution in world history. It outlasted all the empires. So therefore, it is the ultimate political apparatus. And they will want what they perceive to be a safe pair of hands. They'll want a Pope who reflects reality. Now, well, at least I hope they do. And Francis did that. I think he met a lot of resistance from some of the more senior and conservative figures. But I think he broke it through, Matt, because what he's saying is aligning with reality. And this is the issue. Reality is banging on the doors in terms of climate breakdown. So for the next Pope to come in and put his fingers in his ears and ignore it would probably represent a further breach between, I suppose, moral leadership like that and reality.
OK, let's move on to other things. Are offshore wind farms bad for fish stocks? Are they bad for fish? This is one of the arguments, and I'm going beyond Trump believing that they kill loads of whales. There's a lot of arguments in relation to ideas for Ireland and Britain wind farms that it damages the fish ecosystem.
It is an interesting one. I actually attended a public meeting recently in Dunleary where some concerns, environmental concerns, were expressed about the building of offshore wind farms along the sandbanks of Dublin and Wicklow. And I think what's really important to say is that obviously in any industrial development, and their wind farms are definitely that, there's always a trade-off. You can never make, as they say, omelettes without breaking eggs. There is an issue. But what we found on the balance of evidence, Matt, is that when you install wind turbines, when you actually place them in the seafloor, they perform the effect or have the effect of being artificial reefs. And some of your listeners will no doubt have heard, for example, of ships being deliberately scuttled to form artificial reefs, to let them become nurseries for fish in areas of the sea, because fish require something solid against which to attach themselves. So what we've seen, for example, at the base of wind turbines, you get colonies of barnacles, shellfish and various invertebrates attach themselves to those bases. And in turn, they draw in fish. So essentially what the base of wind turbines become are nurseries, allowing, as I said, these various invertebrates, shellfish, etc., they need a grip, they need something to attach onto, and they form the basis of that of a colony. And as I said, they form effectively an artificial reef. And the second, let's be honest, the biggest threat to our marine life in almost all circumstances is bottom trawling. That is the number one effect. And the big advantage of wind farms, Matt, is that they form an area that isn't completely exclusionary to trawling, but it largely keeps them out. Now, I know some fishermen may object to that, but in reality, what we're creating here are artificial reefs. And they're also creating the de facto marine protected areas. And the reason why these are good for fishermen in the longer term is that they give marine species a chance to rebound. If you simply hammer fish, and if you dig up the seafloor with unlimited bottom trawling, all you do is you wipe out the basis for the next generation of fish. And we've seen these cascading collapses of fish populations over and over again. So what we can positively say is that wind turbines give a break. They actually create, as I said, the equivalent of a marine protected area. And there are undoubtedly genuine ecological concerns, for example, around the movement of sandbanks. Let's have a discussion. Let's get in the ecologists. Let's talk about it. But what I heard in that room that night was largely people who don't like looking at wind turbines 10 kilometres from shore. And that's their objection. And the point that I made at that meeting is, if that's your objection, own it. Stand up and say, I don't want wind turbines because I don't like the look of them, and I don't care about climate change. I don't care about importing and burning fossil fuels. I don't care that that's destabilizing the climate and destroying the future for my kids. I don't care about that stuff. I prefer the view. I think we need to be honest. And instead, what I heard were people, if you like, hiding behind environmental arguments, disguising what were essentially NIMBY arguments as environmental arguments. So on balance, yes, there are impacts. For example, when you're installing a wind farm, of course you've got bottom drilling, you're pile driving and so on. So in the short term, that will drive away fish. But they return, and not only do they return, Matt, but they return in abundance.
Okay, something else. And I wonder, how will people really take this one seriously? This suggestion that if Storm Éowyn had come a week earlier than it did, it would have been an absolute disaster. You know, if...
Sure. Well, in fact, I'll give you a better one than that. And this, by the way, is based on research out of the University of Galway. In fact, a few hours earlier, they said we would have run into either a full or a flooding tide. And you'd be looking at Galway City, parts of Limerick and Shannon Airport. So just to run through the numbers, Matt, very briefly, right? Storm Éowyn drove in a 2.5-metre storm surge. So that's what, about 7-foot wall of water it pushed in. Now, further out to the ocean, we had wave heights up to 20 metres. But by the time they reached shores, we're pushing in a storm surge of 2.5 metres. Now, had the tides been slightly different, that storm surge would have come on land above 5 metres. 5 metres. So that's 17 feet storm surge. That would have inundated the centre of Galway City, causing tens, if not hundreds of millions of euros worth of damage. Probably would have destroyed Shannon Airport as well. This was a near miss. And by the way, we had a similar near miss. You remember the Middleton floods about 18 months ago? Again, we were extremely fortunate when they hit Middleton that it happened at a low tide period and a lot of the excess rainfall was able to run away to sea. The problem with this is we're getting closer and closer to a really serious catastrophe. And again, people say, well, where is this coming from? What's going on? We know, for example, that the North Atlantic is much hotter, at times up to 4 degrees warmer than it has been. And the sea surface temperature, the temperature of the top 2 metres of the ocean, that is the fuel, Matt, the rocket fuel that propels ever more powerful storms into our system. That's why, for example, the Caribbean, why we have such devastating storms in the Caribbean is that they have water temperatures in the mid to high 20s. And that provides, again, the fuel for these ferocious storms. But we're seeing hurricane systems starting to track across the Atlantic and actually making it all the way to Ireland.
If you're talking about walls of water that high, though, is that not a good argument against the wind farms being in the Atlantic off the west coast, that they should be in more sheltered seas off the east coast?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complex issue. For example, we also have wind farm developments off the southeast coast around Wexford and Waterford. I agree with you. I think putting wind farms out in the North Atlantic, if you look at a map of Ireland, you'll notice that the western coast coastline is incredibly jagged because it's taking the full brunt of the North Atlantic. And when you put things like wind farms out into roaring seas like that, you do risk them being damaged. And that is certainly an issue. I think they are looking, for example, at the likelihood of using a floating wind turbine installation using similar technology, Matt, for example, as used in some of the oil rigs. So that is a possibility, but I would say that is very experimental. And anybody saying stop building bottom-based wind turbines while we wait for floating turbines, what they're really saying is let's do nothing for the next 20 years. But it is a fair point. We're getting more powerful storms. We're getting stronger storm surges, and these are going to challenge all of our infrastructure. I mean, for example, the Irish Defence Forces a couple of months ago produced a document where they were actually looking at this and saying that we have to weatherise all our systems, including our defence systems.
John Gibbons, as ever, thank you very much.
The Last Word on Today FM.